This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Charles Duhigg had a problem. He was frantically trying to finish a book he was writing. He and his wife had just had their second child, and he was spending his evenings doing his job as a New York Times investigative reporter. He was overwhelmed, trying to take care of his responsibilities and mostly falling behind on everything. So he contacted the writer Atul Gawande to find out how he managed his life, writing books, taking care of his three kids, working as a surgeon, doing interviews, giving speeches, living a very busy life. When Gawande told him he was too busy to talk because he was taking a vacation with his wife and then taking his kids to a rock concert, Duhigg had a revelation and eventually a new book. He wanted to know more about productivity, how and why some people are more productive than others. His new book is titled Smarter, Faster, Better. Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, I guess this book that got him so frantic, The Power of Habit. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Charles Duhigg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what is Atul Gawande's secret to a productive life?
Well, I'm not certain that I ever figured out Atul's secret. But this did launch this investigation where I started talking to what ended up being hundreds of people, researchers and neurologists, people who are particularly productive, companies that seem to have figured out something. And I found that there are these characteristics that the most productive people share. In fact, there were about eight things that I kept on hearing over and over again. And what they generally are they're ways of finding systems to make ourselves, in very small ways, think a little bit more deeply about what we're doing every single day, to hone our focus, to generate self-motivation, to make our teams more healthy. And that tends to be the thing. They're small, but that push us into real productivity.
And I do want to get to all of that. But I do think, maybe picking up on how you were feeling a couple of years ago, I think many people feel like they work really hard. They work really long hours. They have many tasks. And they don't feel productive.
Exactly. And it's incredibly frustrating, right? That's what I felt, is that the harder I was running, the more and more I felt like I was falling behind. And I think the reason why this is so frustrating right now in particular is because we're living through this technological and economic revolution where the promise was everything was supposed to get easier, right? We have these phones that let us communicate with anyone anytime. Any question you have, all you have to do is type it to Google.
That's a terrific thing.
And it's a terrific thing. But like people who lived through the Industrial Revolution or the Agrarian Revolution, as the world changes, it becomes much more important to pay attention to what we know about how our own brains work, because this is a period of transition, and the people who are most successful are the ones who know how to manage their own minds best, even more so now than really ever before.
Maybe because of my age, I sometimes feel like, you know, my brain just does not have enough folds in it to be able to process all the information. You see younger people and they seem much more fluent with all this technology. So how does our brain sort of manage all the data and information that seems to arrive every moment?
Well, in large part by building what are known as mental models, basically stories we tell ourselves. And what we find is that the people who are most productive, they're the ones who indulge this habit the most. I'm sure everyone does this, where you're on your way to work and you kind of think about what your day is going to be like. It turns out that the people who are best at managing information, all the information around them, deciding what to focus on and what to ignore, are the ones who tell those stories a little bit more specifically. They think to themselves, okay, I'm going to try and visualize my day. Like, what's going to happen during that meeting? And then what's going to happen afterwards? And how much time should I set aside for doing emails? Now, this doesn't take a lot of energy, right? I do this actually on the subway myself. Yeah. When I'm on my way to work, it basically takes 10 minutes to kind of visualize my day hour by hour. But what studies tell us is that by doing that, we train our brain to much more quickly be able to distinguish, okay, this is something that lines up with my goals. This is something I should pay attention to. But this other thing that's happening, this email that just arrived, this person who's asking me to answer a question they could just Google themselves, that's a distraction. And I can safely say, No, I don't need to pay attention to it.
I mean, that sounds like being prepared or preparing oneself for one's day at work.
That's exactly right. But it's also being prepared in a very specific way. Because one of the things that we know, and neurological studies tell us this, is that when we are prepared, the best kind of preparation is something that has some type of narrative structure. We tend to think and remember in stories. This is why stories are so powerful when they're written or when we hear them on the radio. And when we can learn to do that for ourselves, we equip our brain to better make very fast decisions. So that's why when you're thinking about the meeting that's coming up, instead of just saying, oh, you know, I have a meeting with Bob and I'm sure by the end of it we'll have some resolution on that project. Thinking to yourself, okay, when the meeting starts, like probably Bob's going to bring up what should be on the agenda. And then halfway through, what I hope to get to is I hope to get to this one point that's important to me. And by the end of the meeting, we should actually have a couple sentences on a piece of paper about how we're going to handle the project. That's a story you've told yourself. That trains and prepares your brain to much more rapidly and easily distinguish what is important and what isn't.
And you have done – I mean, is this something new for you? And have you gotten better results?
I have. I have. I have to actually say – so, I mean, one of the interesting things is I grew up in New Mexico where I was surrounded by a lot of people who talked about visualization, sometimes meaning like past lives and things like that.
Right?
So visualization was kind of this like a little bit of a bad word. But when I started talking to researchers and they said, you know, the most successful athletes and executives, they tend to visualize their days a little bit more specifically. What I heard them saying was this thing about visualization, pushing yourself just an half an inch more to try and really visualize what's going to happen today, that it pays these dividends. I do that now every morning, and it only takes about 10 minutes. I do it on the subway. You can do it while you're driving to work, but it does pay off these huge dividends because what you're trying to do is you're trying to cultivate habits where your brain very quickly filters through all the information that's surrounding us.
And keeps that extraneous information at bay?
That's exactly right. Sometimes just deciding what to pay attention to and what to ignore, that can be really taxing. So the more that we have a mental model, a story we're telling ourselves that lets us quickly sort through that, the more extra brain energy we have to focus on what really matters.
You had a piece actually was in the Times recently, how asking 5 questions allowed me to eat dinner with my kids. I boiled what happened, like a lot of families, it's sort of a chaotic start to the day. Everyone's late, you're running out the door, you're late to work, the kids are late to work, and it goes on from there. What I took away from what you wrote is that sort of how you start the day is how you're probably going to end the day.
Well, it's very interesting you put it that way because I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that – the reason I wrote that piece is, you know, there has been this revolution in the industrial world that's called lean manufacturing or agile methodologies. And when we use those words, we tend to be talking about like making computer chips, right, or auto plants. But one of the things that's interesting is that the ideas at the core of this, they're all tools that we can use for other things. What they're really saying is that when you think a little bit more deeply, you sort of see these connections that you didn't notice before. And there's this thing from the Toyota production system known as the 5 Whys, that when they were making cars in Toyota, and Toyota is one of the most productive, efficient plants on earth, that they would try and solve problems by forcing people to ask why 5 times.
So literally, why?
Literally, why? And so my wife and I had this thing where we always wanted to have dinner with our kids. We know it's important. And we would get home too late every single day. And so I said, look, let's use the 5 Whys. Let's try and figure out what the root problem is. Okay, so we're getting home too late for dinner. Why do we do that? Well, it's because we want to leave the office at like 5 or 5:30, but we always have all these emails to deal with. So why do we have all these emails to deal with at the end of the day? Well, it's because we always get to the office like right before our first meeting starts. So we don't have time to deal with everything in the morning. Well, why do we get to the office right before the first meeting starts? Well, it's because when our kids wake up, we're always late getting out the door, right? We want to leave at 8, but we end up leaving at 8:20. And why do we leave at 8:20? Well, it's because getting our kids dressed is like this like half hour ordeal, right? My son like wants to go through 5 pairs of pants until he finds ones that are fuzzy enough. And so why is it taking so long to get dressed in the morning? Well, it's because like choosing the clothes is such an ordeal. And so the solution is let's ask them to put the clothes that they want to wear out on the floor the night before. And then that way, when they wake up, they just put them on right away.
And that worked?
And it worked. It sounds crazy, but it worked like magic. And here's the thing is if you asked me why we weren't having dinner, I would never say, oh, it's because our morning routine is messed up. But once you sort of use these processes, the system of just sort of taking a step back and saying, like, I have time and space to ask why, and a system to make me ask why enough times, you start seeing these connections in life that help you do things just a little bit better.
You also talk about setting goals. I think it's probably a good thing for people to do, although I'm not necessarily the greatest one at that. But the idea of stretch goals. So these are the big ones, you know, the ones that you're not going to accomplish in a day or a week, but they're big and on the horizon. And then ones you call SMART goals.
That's exactly
more
right.
More step-by-step type goals, I guess.
So it turns out there's a right way and a wrong way to write a to-do list, and it gets exactly to this. So if you think
if you think about
what a to-do list is, it's essentially a contemplation device. It's a way of making us set some priorities and then figure out how to get those priorities achieved. But most people write to-do lists the same way that I used to write them before I started talking to folks about this. You take a couple of big goals, you write them at the bottom of the page, right? Like, I want to run a marathon and lose 30 pounds. But that seems so big and far off. You put it down because you're at the bottom of the
page.
It
ain't going to happen, right?
Right, you know. And then at the top of the page, you put all these things that, like, are easy to do because it feels so good to cross them off. Maybe, and I used to do this myself, maybe you write down something at the top of the list that you've already done.
Absolutely.
So when you sit down, you get to cross it off.
That's not cheating, is it?
It turns out when I was talking to one psychologist, he said, look, that's not using a to-do list for productivity. That's using a to-do list for mood repair. You're using it to make yourself feel good. But what a to-do list should do is it should remind you of what's most important to you. You should take those big goals and you should write them at the top of the page so that you're always reminded, like, this is actually what I'm trying to move towards. This is why I'm doing it. But a big goal, a stretch goal, it can be completely too big, right? It can seem too insurmountable. If you write, I want to run a marathon at the top of your page, where do you start?
Sure.
So under that stretch goal, what researchers suggest is that you have a system to break it down. And one of the most popular is SMART goals. And it's called SMART because you should figure out what specifically you want to get done that day and how you're going to measure it. Is it achievable?
SMA.
Is it realistic? Like, do I need to set aside an hour and a half where I turn off my email so I can get this thing done? What's my timeline? SMART. It's just an easy way to remind yourself, like, how do I break down something into an actual plan? But then you have this to-do list that does two things. It reminds you of what your real priorities are, what's most important, because you've got that big goal at the top of the page. And then underneath it, it tells you how to start. So you don't have to torture yourself or try and figure out what's the first step. You know exactly what to do. And I'll be honest, I actually do a stretch and SMART goal every morning before I go to work.
While you're visualizing your day?
Actually, before I visualize my day, when I'm at home, it takes like 45 seconds. This is not like a big task. But what I do as a result is I've kind of gotten into this habit of saying, what's most important to me today and this week and this month? And how do I make that into something that, like, I can start on as soon as I'm at my desk? It's a device, a contemplation device that forces me just a little bit to think more about what's going on.
That's Charles Duhigg, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about how to be productive, how to be more productive. His new book is called Smarter, Faster, Better: The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Charles Duhigg about his new book, Smarter, Faster, Better, based on a bunch of interviews that he did, some research that he's done, researchers he has talked to, I should say, about how to be productive in a busy time that we all live in. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I was thinking about how, you know, you ask people how they are, everyone says, I'm really busy. But being busy is not the same as being productive.
No. And in fact, that's an important distinction, is that particularly now, it is easier and easier to be busy. And that does not mean that you're necessarily becoming more productive. The most productive people, in fact, often understand that distinction, and they go out of their way to try and not be busy, but to do the things that actually matter. I was talking to one person who was saying, you know, I love email, but here's the problem with email, is that when I start using it as a to-do list, I've given permission to everyone else on earth to add items to my to-do list. And that's not productive. That's busy, but that's not productive. A to-do list should reflect what I think is important, not what the rest of the world wants me to think is important. And understanding that distinction, that helps people take control over how they're spending their time.
I was wondering, too, about – I mean, I think all workplaces are struggling to figure out how to manage people, how to deal with people's work, family, life flow, how to deal with technology, about meetings, about top-down, bottom-up. And I wonder whether workplaces – sometimes make it hard to be productive.
Well, I think that the best workplaces teach us how to be more productive. One of my favorite examples of this is Disney, right? And in the book, we tell the story of the making of Frozen. Now, most people know Frozen because it's this huge blockbuster, right? But what most people don't know is that Frozen was on the brink of catastrophe until literally just months before it was in the theaters. But what Disney has decided and what they realize is that creativity isn't about just finding creative people. In fact, almost anyone can be creative if they're put in the right environment. Creativity and productive creativity is about having the right process in place, a creative process that helps people understand how to take the ideas that they know are real and meaningful and to use them in new ways. So for the Frozen example, you know, when they were at this moment of crisis and they didn't know what this movie was about and there's just literally months to go, they all sat down in the room, the filmmakers, and they said, well, okay, so look, what do we know? Well, Disney knows princesses, right? We have like 70 years of princess stories that we know pretty well. But that's not enough. What else do we know? And Frozen was unusual that it had a large number of women who were working on it. It was actually one of the directors of Frozen is the first female director in Disney's history. And they sat down and they said, well, you know, the other thing that we know is we know sisters, right? We have sisters. And the thing about relationships between sisters is that there's usually not like a bad sister and a good sister. There's just like two sisters who are both kind of messed up and they help each other out. So what if we take these two ideas, the idea of princesses and the idea of sisters, both of which we feel like are real and we understand them, what if we mash them together? If we did that, then all of a sudden, instead of a prince coming in and saving a princess, it could be that these two sisters save each other and that both of them are princesses and that the prince is actually a bad guy. I mean, we don't have to reveal that to the very end. We can create a brand new story by taking what we know and by trying to find something that's true and real in it. Now, the only reason that worked, though, is because Disney has a process, a creative process where they say, look, if you're feeling tense, if you're feeling like things aren't working, go back to what you know and find some way to say it.
Well, in fact, that story, I think, underscores something that you say in the book about creativity, which isn't necessarily coming up with something that no one has ever thought of before, but it's really a fresh synthesis of established, maybe old ideas, but somehow reconfigured in a new and different way.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's why basically anyone can actually be creative, is because we all have these experiences. We all have these things that we know, and we know so well that they've become familiar. And creativity oftentimes is just taking what you know and casting it in a new light, comparing it with a new mate or twin that you haven't ever thought it should belong together before.
And I mean, the question is, and you seem to be saying it isn't necessarily the people that are, let's say, part of a team. It's more the environment or the atmosphere in the team that allows for some kind of problem solving or dealing with some of these problematic issues.
That's exactly right. And that's critical. In fact, another chapter in the book, and we excerpted this in the Times Magazine, is about how Google spent 4 years and millions of dollars trying to figure out how to build the perfect teams. And their initial hypothesis was, oh, well, to build a perfect team, you take all the smartest people and you put them together.
Right.
And maybe you want like people who play Frisbee together, right? Or you want introverts and extroverts. Turns out who is on a team matters much, much, much less than how that team interacts. In fact, you can take people who aren't necessarily your smartest people, and if you put them on a team that has the right culture, they'll tend to be even more productive than all the smarties jammed together if they all fight with each other. And what's critical to a team succeeding is what's known as psychological safety. And psychological safety has these two components. For a team to feel psychologically safe to be successful, everyone at the table has to have the ability to speak up. And they actually have to speak up. You have to stop a meeting and say, like, Jim, I haven't heard from you in a little while. Like, what's going on? What are you thinking about?
So you can't sit quietly listening or...
You got to be pulled into that conversation. But secondly, that's not enough. You also have to have what's known as high social sensitivity, which means that people pick up on when someone is feeling left out, or they pick up on nonverbal cues. People know each other well enough that they can genuinely listen to each other and that they show that they're listening. If you have these two things, this sort of equality and conversational turn-taking and high social sensitivity, study after study, and Google found the same thing was true, that team becomes incredibly successful. Whereas a bunch of smart people who don't have that, they all stay as individuals. They don't become a team.
But how do you create that culture that people feel comfortable enough to speak out, maybe say something that's ridiculous, for instance?
I think it's about how the leader behaves and how everyone else picks up on how the leader behaves. And everyone takes responsibility for it. Right? So one of the things that Google has done is they've come up with a checklist for teams. And some of the things are like pretty simple. Like it says things like, when you start a meeting, close your computer so you can make eye contact with each other. Now, this seems like not rocket science, right? But think about how many meetings you've gone into where people keep their computer open so they can keep an eye on their email and they don't actually make eye contact. They don't learn social sensitivity because it feels more efficient to do that. It feels like we're multitasking in this really efficient way. But what the studies show us is that oftentimes the things that feel efficient, they're actually in contradiction to productivity, that particularly now we can mistake efficiency and busyness for productivity. And so having rules or having the understanding that psychological safety is important, perhaps the most important ingredient, just being reminded of that helps us figure out how do we comport ourselves in a way that actually makes people get more done.
You're also saying that multitasking is not productive. It's not efficient.
Well, so multitasking isn't necessarily a bad thing as long as you're choosing to do it. I mean, what's interesting is that our brain is attracted to multitasking. And this was a great thing for millions of years. If you're someone who can both farm and look for predators at the same time, you've got a huge advantage over someone who can only farm or only look for predators. But in the last century, and particularly in the last 30 years, the thing that's happened is that our brain's propensity to multitask has been overwhelmed by how many distractions and stimuli there are in our environment. And the way that we guard against that now, the way that we make better choices, is to recognize I have the ability to multitask. Mm. And there's some of that that's okay and some of that that's terrible. And I need to put myself in a place where I choose which ones are helpful, which kind of multitasking is helpful and which kind isn't. And really try and build habits around that.
I'm sure we've all had experiences, and I do think that our smartphones makes us feel a little bit like rats in a maze because the buzzer goes off, you know.
Absolutely.
And you know someone just texted you, and the temptation to pull that out and see,
oh my gosh,
who's there. I mean, that's the kind of positive reinforcement.
Absolutely. And companies know that, and they understand that. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this is that if you look at diaries from people from 40 or 50 years ago, there's an unusual number of people who say, like, you know, I had this great idea while I was standing in line because I was kind of bored. Or Saturday Night Live is a good example. Lorne Michaels met Chevy Chase because they were standing on line waiting to see Monty Python at the same movie theater. Now, when's the last time any of us were standing on line and had this moment of like kind of boredom? Never, right? Because as soon as you're bored, you pull your phone out and you start like checking your fantasy football scores or the latest gossip website or something like that, or hopefully the New York Times since I work for them. But this is the point, is that it's very easy to fall into these automatic behaviors where we don't allow ourselves any time for contemplation. We don't allow ourselves time for boredom. But the most productive people, they embrace moments of boredom. They embrace contemplative devices, whether that be going for a run or prayer or meditation or simply saying, next time I'm online, I'm not going to pull out my phone. I'm going to let myself kind of daydream, because they know that that actually gets them to these places where they're more productive over time.
That's Charles Duhigg, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and we are talking about productivity, something that he writes about in his new book. It's titled Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. Wrote a book a couple of years ago. In fact, it was a New York Times bestseller called The Power of Habit, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times. you've had a chance to sense and flavor and taste some of what we've been talking about. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. There's this thing, you know, that research is really me search. Did you find that? I mean, you had this problem, right? You were trying to figure out how to be a more productive person and were able to use some of this research and incorporate it in your own life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this started because I felt like, you know, I went to school. I feel like I had all the makings of success, right? If I pointed to my resume, I could say like, oh, I'm a successful person. But I just found that like, it just felt like I was working harder and harder and being less and less satisfied. And so part of it was, as I was doing this research, I would ask people, usually I'd pose it as, you know, I have this friend who has a problem, but I would ask these questions to say like, what's going on? Because everyone else only has 24 hours in each day, the same number that I have. And yet there are these people who seem like they get so many more important things done. They seem so much more relaxed. And all the psychologists and the neurologists and the researchers I spoke to said, you know what? You're right. They are more relaxed. They do get more important things done because they're forcing themselves to think just a little bit more about the choices that they're making, right? They're figuring out like, how do I want to spend my day? There was an interesting study that was done about email that some researchers looked at this large company and they got access to everyone's email and they found the most productive people inside the company. And what they found is that the most productive people inside the company, they did two things that were interesting. First of all, they deleted way more emails than anyone else. And they would often hit the delete key after only 2 seconds.
Wow.
So they weren't even reading the entire email. They were just looking at an email and they were saying, look, this doesn't fit my mental model, the story I'm telling myself about my day. I don't need to deal with this. And they would just hit delete. But the other thing they were doing is they were looking for projects to work on where they learned. And this is actually a really important insight because when we think about productivity or we think about efficiency, often what we think about is doing the same thing faster and faster and faster, right? I used to make 5 widgets a day. Now I make 10 widgets a day.
And that makes me more productive,
That
right?
makes me more productive. But the most productive people, they actually look for ways to make new widgets. They try and challenge themselves. They try and put themselves in situations where they meet new people and they get exposed to new ideas because that's something that forces us to think about, should I be making widgets in the first place? Is there a better widget I could make? That's where real productivity comes from. It doesn't come from making more widgets. It comes from inventing the smartphone.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, the managers or bosses who have to try to figure out how to motivate people, you know, whether it is inspiration, whether it is positive or negative reinforcement, or how much of this is it about just being self-motivated? I mean, I just think that there are some people, probably some of the people in your book here, that just seem to be more self-motivated.
Well, it's interesting. So one of the things that we know is that self-motivation is like a muscle. You can learn how to strengthen it. And there aren't people who are born with self-motivation. In fact, most people who are really good at self-motivation, they trained themselves. And one of my favorite examples of this is the U.S. Marine Corps. Because about 15 years ago, the Marine Corps noticed that a lot of recruits that were coming in were people who hadn't learned how to self-motivate. And so they changed basic training entirely to try and encourage them to develop this muscle, develop this skill. And the way that they did it is they forced people they forced the recruits to start making a bunch more choices where they felt in control. Because one of the things that we know about our brain is that there's a part of our brain known as the striatum and the basal ganglia, where self-motivation essentially resides. And that part of the brain gets activated when we feel like we're in control of a situation, what psychologists call an internal locus of control. So a great example of this is telling kids that they need to go set the table and not telling them how to do it. When you're sitting down to do emails, deciding to respond to the email that's from the middle of your inbox rather than the one that's at the top. Anything that makes you feel like you're in control of your life actually triggers the sense of self-motivation. It becomes easier and easier. And when this really reaches its full fruition, we end up taking responsibility for all of our choices. There's a great study that looked at nursing homes in this respect. And there was this basic question, why do some people enter nursing homes and pass away relatively quickly, and other people seem to thrive. And what they found was that the distinction was that the people who do well in nursing homes, they look for opportunities to prove to themselves that they're in control of their own lives. Mm. One of the examples of this is that they went into this nursing home, and there was everyone would get served their meal on trays, right? And they talked to this one guy who loved chocolate cake, and he would get served chocolate cake every night by the nursing home. And then he would sit down and he would trade his chocolate cake with other people for like fruit or something else. And they said to him, "You love chocolate cake. Why are you trading it away?" And he said, "I would rather eat a meal of my own design than something that's delicious that's been forced on me." Researchers refer to these people as subversives. Subversives because they look for ways to prove to themselves and everyone else, I'm in control of my own life. And those people in nursing homes who do that, they're much more self-motivated to exercise, to go to the doctor, to keep up relationships with friends. Self-motivation comes from believing we're in control, and we can train ourselves to look for opportunities to take control, even if it's something as small as saying, I'm not going to eat the chocolate cake. I'm going to eat something else.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, and then we'll get some folks in on the conversation. I mean, what you are describing are little things, incremental things. I mean, the idea of I want this chocolate cake so I can sort of wheel and deal with my, you know, the people that I'm living with in this nursing home.
And that's kind of the point, is that the difference between the most productive people and everyone else, they're not huge things. It's not that, you know, you went to a better school or you're richer or your parents taught you some different way. It's that you see small opportunities to make slight improvements. And those improvements inevitably are about giving myself space to just think literally half an inch deeper about what's going on, but it pays huge dividends.
That's Charles Duhigg, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times. A couple of years ago, he wrote a book called The Power of Habit, and now he's got a new one called Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and in Business. You've had a chance to hear about some of these ideas about productivity, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking with Charles Duhigg in this hour of Radio Times. He got interested in productivity when he noticed how busy he was and how hard it was for him to get things done. He talked to a lot of people who had mastered this ability to accomplish a great deal without feeling overwhelmed, in other words, to be productive. And the results of his interviews and some of the researchers he talked to found in his new book called Smarter, Faster, Better. 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a Facebook comment from William. He says, this obsession with productivity is really gross. Maybe it's not all of us who are wrong, but the awful system we live under that constantly demands that we produce more and more. You know, I tried to touch on that early in the hour where people just are feeling this sense of feeling overwhelmed and the demands seem unreasonable and impossible to be able to address.
So I think that's a great comment. And the thing I would say to William is you're right. In a traditional definition of productivity, it can seem gross. But here's the thing that to keep in mind. Productivity is what you want it to be, right? So for me, a productive Wednesday morning might be like getting my kids to school as early as I can so I can get to my desk. But maybe for someone else, it's going for a run. Or maybe it's being able to be relaxed enough that I can talk to my kids as I drive them to school in the morning. A productive Saturday morning looks very different from a productive Wednesday morning. Productivity isn't about doing more and more and more and pushing things out the door. Productivity is about having the space and the ability to decide what's important to you. A productive day could be a day where you get to pamper yourself and you get to really enjoy your life without being stressed out about all the emails that are building up. Becoming productive is about being able to recognize the choices you can make to decide what goals are important to you and then how to get to those goals with the least waste and the least stress.
An email from Mark says, my question relates to enhancing team productivity. How can this be done in a multinational corporation where the majority of the team are not sitting together? And it's true, people are scattered. They're working from home. They're working from all over the world sometimes.
We have a lot of data on that. And what's critical is, again, this thing I mentioned, psychological safety. Psychological safety isn't based on all being in the same room, although that can help.
Right.
What psychological safety is based on is actually being able to speak up and to listen to each other. So sometimes if I'm in a room and I can see that you've crossed your arms and you look upset, I can stop and I can say, you know, Susan, it looks like you're having a problem with what we're talking about. Why don't you tell us what's going on inside your head? But if I'm not in the same room with you, it's about being particularly attuned to, if I'm on a video call, what does your facial expressions look like? If I can't see you, what can I pick up about the timbre of your voice? Have I not heard – do I have a list of who's on this call and have I not heard from some of you in 20 minutes, which means you're probably kind of disengaged from what's going on? Being multinational, we know that the world is increasingly becoming physically located, right? Mm-hmm. Being on conference calls, being all over the world – that's not going to change. But what we can change is how we become sensitive to really listening to each other, that we don't use not being in the same room as an excuse to stop listening. We look for ways to actually make sure everyone is speaking up in that meeting.
You talk about creating an atmosphere of trust. There's the STAR model, the engineering model, the bureaucratic model, the autocratic model. I think we know what some of those are. And the commitment model. And that's, you're saying that's really the one that allows for a more productive workplace.
There was this fascinating study that was done by these professors at Stanford where they looked at all of these tech startups and they tried to figure out what kind of culture was the most powerful culture. Now, going into it, they thought that the STAR culture would be the big winner, right? You take the smartest people that you can find, you put them in a room, you let them invent something amazing. And that's what venture capitalists think too. But as they followed the data for 15 years, they found that actually the best performing companies were commitment companies. They were companies where bosses said things like, you know, I hope that the only way people leave this company is if they retire or die. They would use their precious dollars to hire HR folks rather than engineers. They would institute policies that in the short term look like they might be counterproductive, like giving people longer maternity leaves, letting them take time off if they've got something going on at home. But what they found is that those companies that were commitment companies, as a group, they were the fastest to IPO. They had the highest profitability ratios. Hmm. Not one commitment company that they studied went out of business. Now, there are some STAR companies that also did well, but there were also lots of STAR companies that flamed out, where everyone wanted to be the STAR, so they would fight with each other constantly. And the message here really is that the data tells us that if you invest in your employees, if you invest in your colleagues, it ends up paying off. And the reason why is because the biggest cost you can have is when someone great leaves and they take your ideas to a competitor, they take clients with them, or when someone says, this isn't a place where I can stay once I have kids or it's going to be able to take care of me throughout my life. Instead, I'm going to try and, you know, find the best deal I can. Companies that invest in their employees, according to the data, are the ones who end up being most productive over time.
Let me see what Molly from Philadelphia has to say. Molly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I work with senior executives and their leadership teams in the Fortune 1000. And the topic of productivity is one that is quite pervasive. And one of the things that I wanted to add to the conversation is the notion that the speed, complexity, and volume of the workplace today really necessitates that executives and the workforce in general, the knowledge workers, move from just basic productivity, which I think I hear David pointing to about this whole replication of widgets, the automation of business, into productivity equaling innovation. And that organizations ultimately really need to be thinking organizations. There's a great book called Think or Die, and that is so essential in today's world. And I really like what I hear in the undertones of what you're pointing to in the conversation, and I just wanted to add to it, and thank you.
No, Molly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Innovation.
It's a huge part of what we're doing. I mean, I think in many ways what you're saying, Molly, which is a great point, is it seems like the companies that are most successful and the executives are most successful are the ones who find ways to force themselves to think a little bit more, right? Hmm. There is a natural inclination to mistake busyness for productivity and to say, oh, I just got to inbox zero, or I put out 5 memos today and I was really busy, so I must be doing something right. But that's not the right way of looking at it. The people who are most productive, the people who genuinely do the most important work and the work that has the biggest results, are the ones who say, "This, I don't need to get to inbox zero. What I need to do is I need to clear out an hour and a half, and instead of dealing with emails, I need to sit and think about the problems that are in front of me. I need to write a to-do list where instead of having 30 things that I can cross off, I have 5 things, but they're the right things. They're the most important things. They're my stretch biggest ambitions that I want to get done." The more that you can create systems, devices to force yourself to think, the more you're going to end up being genuinely productive instead of just busy.
Molly, thanks for the call. Let me see what Todd from Wayne has to say. Hi, Todd. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Fascinating discussion. Really enjoying it. I know there's a lot of takeaways for me. I'm a parent, though, and I'm calling about my son, who's 19, a freshman in college. He's very bright, but he's paralyzed by anxiety and really has trouble prioritizing and gets himself in such a mental state that he's completely unproductive. And to the point he's having trouble sleeping. And I've told him before he goes to bed, make a list of the things you got to do the next day so you can at least calm your mind down and sleep knowing it's written down. But I was wondering if you had advice for, you know, teenagers, young adults like my son who, you know, are having trouble prioritizing and being productive.
Todd, it's such an important question. And he's a lucky kid to have you as a dad. Let me see what our guest, Charles.
No,
Duhigg,
absolutely.
Has to say.
I think the fact that you care and you're working with him on this is the most important thing. And in addition, I think that's a great idea to say, like, write down what's going on so you can just kind of get it out of your head a little bit. But the second thing I think that's important to emphasize is there is anxiety. We tend to see failure as something bad. But people who are genuinely productive, they don't see failure as a bad thing. They see it as an experiment that gave them some data about what to avoid next time. Right? A lot of the anxiety that we feel, this fear of missing out or this fear of making the wrong choice, it's because we think that the wrong choice doesn't yield anything useful. But in fact, what's interesting about these super productive people and kids, for this matter, is that they tend to celebrate failure. They tend to say, like, you know, I tried this thing and it didn't work, but here's what I learned about it, and I'm not going to make that mistake again. When I was growing up, I was really into debate, and whenever I would lose a debate round, I would come home and my dad would say, you know, that was great that you made the other kid feel really, really good about themselves, and you learned what not to do next time. We would kind of celebrate these losses because a loss isn't really a loss, right? Missing out on something isn't really a mistake. The anxiety is just about this need to see things as binary successes or failures. But once you recognize that every single choice we make is an experiment, and that if the experiment goes awry, that's okay, because the point of experiments is to teach us what we shouldn't do next time, then hopefully it alleviates that anxiety a little bit.
And kind of reframing the dilemma, I guess.
That's exactly right. And look, I mean, to your point, it is tough to be a college student at any time,
sure.
And it's particularly tough to be a college student right now. There feels like there's so much pressure, right? If I don't make the right choice when I'm 19 years old, the rest of my life is going to be terrible. And we know that that's not true. But the way that we help our kids learn that is we encourage them to see mistakes as an okay thing. I was talking about subversives earlier. You know, one of the things that's really interesting about all the research about teaching kids to self-motivate is that we need to encourage them to think like subversives. And as a parent, that's really hard, because when my 7-year-old doesn't want to put on his pants because fuzzy enough, and he fights me on what he wants to wear in the morning, my instinct is to say, look, just put on the pants. Like, you're driving me nuts. But actually, it's great that he's fighting me. It's great that he's creating some system where he forces himself to think about what he actually wants. These things that our kids do that drive us crazy, those are the things that oftentimes we have to encourage. And when they're anxious, we have to say, look, that anxiety, that means you're getting closer to the right goal. It's okay to feel that way. particularly if you're learning from it.
Well, and I guess, Todd, hopefully that's helpful to you, and hopefully that will help your son as well. And I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Carissa to join us from Philadelphia. Carissa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say that I read his Power of Now, or I'm sorry, the Power of Habit book.
Yes.
Recently, actually, within the past year. And based on that book, I created my own planner to kind of organize my personal life. Whereas before, you know, I was just paralyzed when I would get home with the free time that I had. And I, instead of doing all these things that I wanted to do with my time, I would just do nothing, or I would do the easiest thing, and that would just be clean my house or watch TV. But now I'm actually, you know, exercising regularly and
wow.
doing all of these things that I've never done before, developing hobbies that I've never done before. So to the commenter's point before about the productivity being disgusting, I actually think this sort of conversation about productivity and how to be more productive in your life can bring more meaning into your personal life when you apply it in the way that he's talking about.
Well, Carissa, thanks. I'm sure that our guest is very happy that you called into Radio Times.
No,
well.
I really appreciate it. And I think the point you raise is a really good one. The productivity is actually about freedom, right? It's about control. Like when you are productive, it means you have more control over your life, that you're not reacting to all the things around you. You're not doing what everyone else thinks that you should do. Instead, you're taking control and you're saying, look, here's what's important to me. I want to get to those goals as fast as I can and as with the least waste and stress. It means the freedom to make the choices that are important to you instead of just following the choices that everyone else wants to force on you.
Carissa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I scribbled down the word grit, and that's one of the words that's being used today to talk about a kind of a stick-to-itiveness, that kids or students that have grit seem to do better in school. How do you think about grit?
So I think so. And there's some great research from Angela Duckworth at UPenn about grit and about what makes people particularly gritty and able to follow through on commitments. You know, one of the things that we found is that they do have these devices for thinking more about life. And it's interesting. If you look sort of historically, what are the things about human culture that have persisted? There's things like prayer, right, or meditation. Exercise, going and listening to music. None of those things seem particularly productive, right? unless God's actually listening and giving you what you want, prayer does not necessarily seem predictive. But what's interesting is that those are all contemplation devices. Those are ways that we carve out time in our day and our lives to think about what's important to us, to think about how we get closer to what's important. And one of the things we know about people who have grit is that they have built those contemplation devices into their life. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be religious. It doesn't mean you have to meditate. I hate meditating. I think it's super boring. But it does mean that you have to experiment with different ways of allowing some more thoughtfulness into your life and that you have to pay attention to what works for you and what doesn't. For me, what works is going for a run and listening to some music and being able to think about what's going on and what's important. And experimenting with different methods of figuring out how to allow contemplation is in and then listening to the data that you generate about your own life, that's where grit comes from. That and being surrounded by a community that supports that type of activity. That's why so many of these things that happen, prayer, meditation, exercise groups, they happen in group settings because we know that it's oftentimes easier to learn about what we should be doing by being able to reflect on it with other people.
Hmm. Well, on that note, we're going to end our conversation. Charles Duhigg, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. And Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Abby Sarfo, our intern for today's edition of the show. Diana Martinez, our engineer. The show was produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. And we have run out of music there. We need to make sure the music keeps going. And helping us out today is Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us today for Radio Times.